This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the April 13th edition of Takes on the World. A public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. In the midst of the seemingly endless stomach-turning election season, we have heard a lot from the candidates, if the voters give them the opportunity, how hard they will come down on the Islamic State or ISIS once they're given the keys to the Oval Office. One would think from their statements, particularly those of the Republicans, that the Islamic State's the greatest terrorist threat to the world, as the world's ever faced. If so, one might have expected that they, as well as the American media, would welcome its recent defeat in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra by government troops backed by Russian airstrikes. Not so. As it turned out, their antagonism toward Vladimir Putin and Russia trumps their concern about ISIS. Either the retaking of this ancient Syrian city with its famous ruins by the troops of Bashar al-Assad with Mr. Putin's help was ignored or treated as a mixed blessing, as exemplified in a news report by NPR the following Monday, which described the town as being held by ISIL, quote, before it fell back into government hands last weekend, end quote. That comment, which I also heard in offhand manner in which that historic defeat of ISIS was viewed by America's political class, spurred author and anthropologist Barbara Nimre Aziz to pen an article for the Daily Counterpunch website entitled An Impossible Syrian Victory. At 25 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with her about the failings of U.S. media coverage of the war in Syria, where she once taught and spent a number of years. So stay tuned for that. The biggest story to break since my last program was the release by the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung of what are being called the Panama Papers, the result of a collective effort by a consortium of international journalists. They contain the names of more than 11 million non-Panamanians who opened shell accounts through the Panamanian Law Office of Mossack and Fonseca in order to conceal funds from would-be tax collectors and prying publics. The list appears to be a who's who of corporation heads representing virtually every country, every continent, and some of their close friends. The first to make the headlines is British Prime Minister David Cameron, whose wealthy father had apparently used a law firm to keep an investment fund hidden from public sight. Cameron's first response was to deny the existence of the fund and sharply criticize what he called, quote, the deeply hurtful and profoundly untrue allegations, end quote. By the end of the week, he was acknowledging that he and his wife Samantha owned shares in an offshore fund, Blairmore Holdings, set up by his late father, before he said selling it for £30,000 in 2010, so he claimed. One of the more interesting figures caught up in the scandal is Ukraine's pro-Western president, the oligarch Petro Poroshenko, who has found himself in a political storm over the leaked documents from the Panamanian firm showing him having holdings he claimed to have gotten rid of. Critics of Vladimir Putin have tried to rope him into the scandal, despite his name not showing up in any account. Robert Perry of Consortium News, a frequent guest on the program, pointed out that, quote, the new anti-Putin allegations, ballyhooed by the UK Guardian and other outlets, and particularly noteworthy because the so-called Panama Papers that supposedly implicate him in offshore financial dealings never mention his name. Or, as the Guardian writes, quotes, though the president's name does not appear in any of the records, the data reveals a pattern. His friends have earned millions from deals that seemingly could not have been secure without his patronage. The documents suggest Putin's family has benefited from this money. His friends' fortunes appear his to spend, end quote. None, if you will, writes Parry, notes the lack of specificity and the reliance on speculation, a pattern seemingly suggests appear. Indeed, if Putin were not already a demonized figure in the Western media, such phrasing would never pass an editor's computer screen. Indeed, notes Perry, the only point made in the declarative phrasing is that, quote, the president's name does not appear in any of the records, end quote. The Panama Papers scandal came as no surprise to the folks at Public Citizen. In 2009, they issued a paper warning that the U.S. free trade agreement with Panama, a leftover from the Bush administration, would be the vehicle which shady bankers, businessmen, and drug lords would continue to use or set up new shell accounts, since the country carved out of Colombia at the time of the opening of the Panama Canal was already being used as a tax haven. Citizens United paper said it all, quote, the title of it, Panama FTA would undermine U.S. efforts to stop offshore tax haven abuse and regulate risk, end quote. Its executive summary began with a promise from newly elected president Barack Obama in a speech to Congress on February 24, 2009. Quote, "We will restore a sense of fairness and balance to our tax code by finally ending the tax breaks for corporations that ship our jobs overseas," end quote. Despite opposition from unions and many House Democrats, President Obama and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton both sold the FTA to Panama as fixing the Panama tax haven security secrecy issue. Thanks to the leadership of Panama, President Martinelli, said Obama at the time, there have been a change of significant reforms in banking and taxation in Panama, and we are confident now that a free trade agreement would be good for our country, end quote. Secretary of State Clinton chimed in, according to Reuters, saying that Washington hoped to enact two long-delayed free trade agreements with Colombia and Panama. Quote, "We are making great progress in both agreements," she said, noting they included steps to guarantee labor rights in Colombia and ensure tax transparency in Panama that will help win U.S. lawmakers' approval of the trade deals, end quote. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time that Panama was a world leader when it came to allowing wealthy Americans and large corporations to evade U.S. taxes by stashing their cash in offshore tax havens. The Panama Free Trade Agreement, he said at the time, will make this bad situation much worse. Speaking of trade and trade deficits, which have been bandied about by our presidential candidates, with Sanders expressing the most principled opposition, a front-page story in the New York Times of March 28th shed a new light on the subject. In an article largely aimed at supporters of Donald Trump and headlined, "No, cutting the trade deficit won't make America great again," the Times' Neil Irwin explained why the deficit is useful for Washington. Among its benefits, wrote Irwin, is that, quote, "it helps ensure that the United States can afford to finance wars, and it gives the government greater ability to fight recessions and panics. A country experiencing a banking panic will see money sent out of the country, causing its currency to fall and its interest rates to rise. All that limits a government's options for fixing the problem." In 2008, Irwin writes, when the United States experienced a near collapse of the banking system, the opposite happened. But it's not just economics, he notes, and quotes Jennifer Harris, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and author of a coming book, War by Other Means, on the use of economic tools in foreign policy. According to Harris, quote, "a lot of the benefits of having the reserve currency are more on the foreign policy side than the economic. In this regard," quote, she says, "the centrality of the dollar to global finance gives the United States power on the global stage that no other country can match." Irwin goes on. He said, Irwin notes it has enforced sanctions on Iran, Russia, North Korea, and terrorist groups with the implicit threat of cutting off access to the dollar payment system for any bank in the world that does not cooperate with American foreign policy. Part of what makes the United States powerful is the great importance of the dollar to global finance. And part of the price the United States pays for that status is a stronger currency and higher trade deficits than would be the case otherwise. The debate over the trade deficit is about more than Mexico and China. Cars and bananas are winning and losing, concluded the Times' Neil Irwin. It's about what makes America great and which of the country's priorities should come first, end quote. That's a rare bit of honest analysis on the New York Times, but frankly, if Irwin is not being cynical, I find his criteria for what makes a country great deplorable. Also deplorable, yet another headline in the New York Times last Friday, similar to what we've seen before and will likely see again. On the bottom of the inside page, it reads, quote, "Civilians killed in U.S. airstrikes. Afghan officials say Americans deny account," end quote. This one killed 17 civilians, among them a local elder who was on his way to mediate a tribal land dispute. That elder, Haji Razruddin, was reportedly strongly anti-Taliban and traveled with four bodyguards for that reason, all of whom also died in the blast from a Hellfire missile. A second strike soon after killed two people who had come to collect their bodies, and still a third strike murdered three more civilians who climbed a small hill nearby to try and see what had happened and why the two men sent previously had not returned, according to the Times. The district governor said an investigating team had determined that the people killed were civilians, But what is the word of an Afghan official against that of a spokesman for the U.S. military? In this instance, Brigadier General Charles H. Cleveland. Said Cleveland, "We can confirm that the U.S. conducted two counterattacks in Paktika on Wednesday afternoon. There was no evidence to indicate that there were any civilian casualties at all." End quote. It's time like this to recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who on April 4, 1967, speaking in New York's Riverside Church, described the United States as, quote, "the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today," end quote. 49 years later, to our everlasting shame, it not only still retains that dubious title, but also, without question, another one. America is the greatest purveyor of state terror in the world today, and no other country comes close. Tomorrow night on CNN, former Secretary of State Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders will square off again in debate before the critical New York State primary next Tuesday. Sanders has won 7 of the last 8 contests, but Clinton is heavily favored to win in New York, where a victory for Sanders is a must. He has also had to weather a constant stream of attacks and snide remarks leveled at him from the liberal media across the entire spectrum. Thus far, Sanders has been endorsed by 8 members of the House, none from California. One of them, Hawaii's Tulsi Gabbard, an Indian American and Iraq War veteran, who until she decided to endorse Sanders, was seen as an up-and-coming new face of the Democratic Party. In order to give her endorsement, however, she not only had to ignore warnings from fellow Democrats, she had to resign from the prestigious position as vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, which has made it clear from the beginning that Clinton is the party's choice. On March 9th, following Sanders' upset victory in Michigan, Gabbard was questioned about her support for the Vermont senator by CBS's News' DeMarco Morgan. In case you hadn't heard it, I thought the exchange was worth listening to on the eve of tomorrow's debate.
First, let's get your thoughts off of Sanders' win last night there in Michigan.
Well, it was incredible to see how the people of Michigan really stood up and let their voices be heard. You know, a lot of folks were saying that that was a race in Michigan that Sanders just could not win. But I think it really shows the power of our democracy and the power of people's voices when they are moved by some of these issues that are so important to all of us to go out and take action. And so we're very pleased with the outcome of that race last night.
Congresswoman, you were a member of the DNC committee and you recently resigned and endorsed Sanders. Why now? And why did you leave?
You know, as vice chair of the DNC, all DNC officers are supposed to remain neutral in our Democratic primaries, obviously, including our presidential primary. And I just got to a point where, as a soldier, as a war veteran, I was so frustrated that the most important issue, in my view, the question of war and peace and what qualities we're looking for in our next commander-in-chief, were simply not being addressed. I felt that I could no longer stand on the sidelines, and I needed to get in and to speak out, not only for myself. You know, I saw the cost of war firsthand during my first deployment, which was to Iraq. I worked in a medical unit. But for all of my brothers and sisters and for the American people, to point out the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on this issue of war and peace, on which candidate I feel would take us down a path towards peace, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who has shown through her record and her current positions that she will continue us to take us down this road of interventionist regime change wars that have cost us far too much.
But Congresswoman, there is a large delegate deficit in place. Clinton obviously has a massive lead when it comes to delegates. Sanders, it could possibly be impossible for him not to catch up, and you still chose to endorse him. Is that good for the party?
Well, because there are many, many states and many people across the country who have yet to cast their votes. And while I know many political pundits like to say that this is impossible, it's not over until it's over. And I have faith in our democracy. And Senator Sanders is promising to carry his message and to bring this choice and allow the American people to choose in this Democratic primary who they would like to see go forward and represent them in the general election.
What about any retaliation? The Clintons have had a well-oiled machine in Washington for years. Do you fear any retribution from the Clintons? And what's your relationship been like with it?
Well, you know, I was heavily warned by people who care about me to not endorse Senator Sanders because of that fear of retaliation. And And look, that fear is something that exists in a lot of folks that I've heard from. There is far too much at stake here to stand on the sideline and let politics get in the way of what's real. And what's real is war and the cost of war. I've seen and felt that cost firsthand through my service and my deployments to the Middle East. And I cannot stand on the sidelines and do nothing when we have a clear choice that many people are not informed about. There are very stark differences between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that people know what those differences are so they can at least make an educated and informed decision.
Critics say Sanders is weak when it comes to foreign policy. Hillary Clinton clearly has experience since she was former Secretary of State. Could he or is he ready to become a commander-in-chief?
I'm glad you asked that question, DeMarco, because it's important for the American people, for us to make a distinction between experience and judgment. And I'll tell you as a soldier, what I look for as I'm examining who should be our next commander-in-chief is someone who exercises good judgment, someone who has foresight, and someone who has this military mindset, which means you take a look at a specific course of military course of action, and you analyze it carefully to really look at what will the consequences of that course of action be? How will our enemies react to that? What will our reaction to that be? And go through this process so we know exactly how things are likely to play out before that action is taken. And I know through my conversations with Senator Sanders and through his record that he does have that good judgment to make sure that we are no longer spending our precious resources and lives in these interventionist regime change wars, and instead use those resources to nation build and invest in our communities right here at home.
And Congresswoman, one final question for you. In the event that Sanders is not the nominee, will you throw your support behind Hillary Clinton? And do you think his supporters will follow?
Well, DeMarco, we'll cross that bridge if and when we get there. I and a lot of others are going to do everything that we can to make sure that Senator Sanders is our Democratic nominee that we're going to take through the general election and beyond.
All right. You have spoken. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, thank you so much.
And it was Tulsi Gabbard.
First, let's get your thoughts off of...
That was Tulsi Gabbard from the 2nd Congressional District speaking on CBS March 9th. Finally, there's an incident that took place in Israeli-occupied Hebron in late March that has led to an unprecedented verbal attack by Israelis, that is, Israeli Jews, against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the heads of the Israeli Defense Force, who are ordinarily viewed in the most heroic light. It was a cold-blooded assassination of a wounded Palestinian by an Israeli soldier in Hebron that was captured on video. Be assured, the eruption of anger was not because Israelis suddenly acknowledged the injustice of their decades of occupation of Palestinian land or the ethnic cleansing that preceded it. Far from it. On that March afternoon, two young Palestinian men tried to stab Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint in occupied Hebron, an act of that is sanctioned by international law, but which is never mentioned when the occupiers are Israelis. After lightly wounding a soldier, one Palestinian was quickly shot and killed, and the other wounded, and as the video taken of the scene shows, he lay bleeding and unattended on the ground as Israeli soldiers stood around idly chattering. An Israeli blogger described the scene. Quote, "The Palestinian who'd been wounded, Abul al-Fatah al-Sharif, lay on the ground near a group of settlers and soldiers. One of the settlers said to the soldiers, quote, this a-hole here is still breathing. An IDF soldier who was a medic in the unit and who treated the wounded soldier asked permission from his commanding officer to, quote, finish off the wounded Palestinian. Apparently, the commander approved. The soldier walked to within 6 feet of the wounded Palestinian, cocked his rifle, and shot him. This practice is often called, quote, confirming the kill in the IDF. The immediate excuse offered by the soldier for the execution was that the wounded Palestinian might have been carrying a bomb, but no one was buying it. An Israeli doctor, after watching the video, commented, quote, maybe it's because I'm a doctor, but when I watched the video, I couldn't take my eyes off the Magen David Adam medical team. That's like the Israeli Red Cross. At the scene, treating the wounded soldier, completely ignoring the man lying wounded on the street, evacuating the soldier in an ambulance, and then, boom, a murder. Such executions of Palestinians are not unusual. What was different is like what we have seen with police killings in the U.S. It was caught on video. Moreover, another video showed the killer walking over afterward to be congratulated with a handshake from Baruch Marzel, a Boston-born settler leader and disciple of the late racist Rabbi Meir Kahane and his cock party. The group was outlawed by Israel in 1994 after Koch supporter, American-born doctor Baruch Goldstein, gunned down 29 Muslim worshippers as they were praying at the Cave of the Patriarchs, also in Hebron. I should mention that there is a monument to Goldstein in a nearby Jewish settlement of Efrat, and settlers in Israel consider Goldstein to be a hero. In the most recent instance, the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of the Israel Defense Forces were forced to respond and condemn the murder as being unacceptable practice for an army that claims to be the most moral on the planet. Some right-wing politicians and their supporters, however, reacted angrily to their response, forcing Netanyahu to backpedal at the start of the next cabinet meeting. Quote, "Any challenge to the morality of the IDF is outrageous and unacceptable," he said. "The soldiers of the IDF, our children, maintain high ethical values while courageously fighting against bloodthirsty murderers under difficult operational conditions. I am certain that in all cases, as in the current one, the inquiry takes into account all conditions. We must support the IDF chief of staff, the IDF, and our soldiers who safeguard our security." A poll taken by Israel's Channel 2 showed that 57% of Israeli Jews said there was no need to arrest a soldier or launch an investigation into the killing, while over 40% considered the soldier's action responsible. Only 5% considered the killing to be an act of murder, which is consistent with polls taken during Israel's periodic wars on Gaza, which showed them to have been supported by 94% of Israel's Jews. I have been unable to find any record of an Israeli soldier ever being sent to prison for murdering a Palestinian. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you very much for listening.